Star Trek, Maverick. The illusion of self. A distress signal from a maroon ship in deep space brings the Maverick to a world where nothing is as it seems and the secret's hidden spell doom for everyone on board. Rated General, no prior knowledge of the Magnificent Seven is required. The crew of the Maverick are Captain Chris Larrabee, Commander Buck Wilmington, First Officer, Lieutenant Commander Alex Stiles, Chief Science Officer, Lieutenant Commander Ezra Standish, Chief of Security, Lieutenant Mary Travis, Protocol Officer, Dr. Nathan Jackson, Chief Medical Officer, Counselor Josiah Sanchez, Ship's Counselor, Lieutenant Julia Pemberton, Chief Engineer, Lieutenant Vin Tanner, Officer of the Con, Ensign J.D. Dunn, Navigator, Yeoman Casey Wells, Captains Yeoman and Ines Resillos, Ship's Bartender.
Chapter 1. The Mutiny. Chris Larrabee was bored. Unfortunately, everyone else on the bridge of the Maverick knew it too. In fact, the senior staff was so aware of his boredom, the current odds over who would be first to throw him bodily into a torpedo tube was growing increasingly high. It started simply enough, drumming of fingers against his command chair, followed by wistful sighs of restlessness waiting for something to happen. Inquiries of the communications officer at regular intervals of 2 minutes soon followed. After a while, J.D. Dunn flinched every time the captain shifted in his chair. The ensign was starting to think he had somehow failed his captain for not finding something to end the man's tedium. After a while, Chris moved from harassing J.D. to the science station where Lieutenant Commander Stiles was running stellar cartography sensor sweeps to gain a more precise map of the sector. The second officer seemed to answer all his questions in stride. As always, she wore that mercurial expression on her face telling everyone they had better have a good reason for approaching her. Those who knew Alex personally would realize she wasn't aloof but somewhat reserved with her opinions. Still, it mystified everyone how she was able to tolerate the captain's incessant badgering.
"Chris,"
Vin Tanner spoke up to take the captain's mind off his boredom. He noticed Lieutenant Commander Ezra Standish idling with his phaser, probably calculating the odds of getting away with justifiable homicide.
"You up for some mountain climbing on the holodeck?"
The statement was no surprise to anyone because the captain and the helmsman spent a great deal of off-duty time engaging in all sorts of outdoor activities. Last week it was whitewater rafting on the Colorado River, and the week before, it was hiking up Mount Celia. Now the flavor of the week looked to be mountain climbing. Everyone held their breath in anticipation, hoping the suggestion of a holodeck adventure might get the captain off the bridge.
"Sure,"
Chris sighed with resignation since not much else was happening on the bridge. He stared at the view screen ahead and saw, to his disappointment, nothing but stars flying past the ship as the Maverick cruised languidly at warp 3.
"When does your shift end?"
"In about an hour. I thought we might try the Machapachare."
"You intend to scale those heights?"
Ezra's face showed his disapproval. The infamous Fishhook Mountain in the Himalayas was one of the most challenging climbs for even the most seasoned participant. Throughout its long history as a venue for climbers, the real Machapachare had claimed many lives, and Ezra could not imagine why anyone undertook such an arduous activity for entertainment.
"Yep."
Vin dismissed Ezra's comment since the security chief complained about any form of recreation that required breaking a sweat.
"It's been done by others."
"Take it easy," Ezra, Chris drawled, aware the security officer's main concern was the fact that Vin preferred to disengage the holodeck safety protocols when he performed any adventure sport.
Takes all the fun out of it if you can't even get a scraped knee.
The helmsman once said to his captain after Nathan Jackson dragged Vin into his ready room the last time the man had been forced to treat the Vulcan for broken ribs from a fall. Safeties will be on.
I am gratified to know that, Captain. I do not relish having to face my security team and inform them I have to assign someone to guard you while you are climbing a mountain.
Although,
JD grinned at the chief,
it would have been fun to see their faces when you did.
A ripple of laughter moved through the bridge, and the earlier tension dissolved for the moment. Chris glanced over his shoulder.
Anything interesting, Commander?
He asked Alex again since she had been somewhat silent during this exchange. The question seemed to irk her, and she straightened up.
Captain, you know I have the greatest respect for you.
The captain exchanged a puzzled glance with both Ezra and Vin at the remark before replying.
I do. Why?
So you understand when I say this with all due respect, if you do not stop asking me that same question at intervals of every 2.34 minutes, I will have to throw you into the warp core.
Soft sniggers moved across the bridge because no one wanted to be caught chuckling at their science officer's statement, no matter how deserved it was. Ezra was suddenly busying himself with his security console. Vin pretended to watch the stars flying past him on the view screen, biting down to avoid laughing. At navigation, JD found it necessary to make a slight course correction. Chris frowned and replied somewhat quietly.
Point taken. You'll let me know if something is up.
The minute it happens.
She let out a sigh of relief that he did not take too much offense at her words since some commanders would.
Mr. Dunn, Mr. Tanner.
Ezra looked at his fellow bridge officers.
I do believe you both owe me 10 credits each.
10 credits on what?
Chris glared at them suspiciously.
That Alex would be the first one to break.
Vin grinned, earning him a dark look from the lady.
Have I been that annoying?
Chris eyed his senior staff, daring them to respond. Vin, Ezra, and JD looked at each other in silent agreement before answering in perfect unison.
Absolutely not, sir.
Alex muttered under her breath.
Cowards.
Unaware of how close the ship had come to mutiny, Commander Buck Wilmington was presently at Four Corners with Counselor Josiah Sanchez going over the monthly crew evaluations. It was a task he hated doing but discovered, much to his chagrin, was his responsibility as the first officer of the USS Maverick. Buck hated to think any crew member was a lost cause, no matter how overwhelming the evidence might be. If it were not for Josiah helping him make the necessary decisions, Buck would never be able to file a negative report on anyone.
Well, Vin's situation is improving.
Buck commented as he studied the Vulcan's evaluation.
Mostly because Chris has made it his business to make sure he speaks his mind a little more.
Being caught between two cultures can be very difficult,
Josiah commented.
However, he holds up well under pressure, and I think he's starting to come out of that shell of his a little more, not just with the captain and commander styles. He had something of a problem I told him to see Lieutenant Travis about.
I see.
Buck looked at Josiah and noted the counselor chose not to elaborate, which meant asking would be a waste of time. Instead, Buck merely nodded in response before taking a sip of his coffee and adding further.
When he gets talking, you can't shut him up, and he's got quite a temper on him. Keeps it inside most of the time, but when it goes, it goes.
That's just the Vulcan in him. Most people forget the reason Vulcans subscribe to a non-emotional state is because of how heated their passions can be if provoked. Case in point, the Romulans.
Buck could not disagree. Although similar in appearance, Romulans and Vulcans were so diametrically opposed in culture and way of life that it was impossible to imagine they were once the same race. Vin came from a highly volatile stock, and though he appeared human in every way, he was not.
I suppose so.
What about Mr. Dunn?
A genuine smile of pleasure stole across Buck's face at the mention of the ensign.
Well, his performance on the bridge is excellent. He's conscientious, eager, still green as hell, but he listens.
The pride in Buck's voice was just as unmistakable as the smile on his face. Since coming on board, it was Buck's responsibility to train JD, and the kid had not failed to disappoint. Seeing the world through JD's eyes made Buck remember what it was like when the galaxy was a new, exciting place to be. In some ways, it still was, but
But experience changed Buck too much for him to enjoy it like he had when he had first emerged from the academy.
Well, they weren't wrong when they marked him as potential captain material,
Buck concluded with more than just pride. This time, he was speaking as JD's superior officer.
A couple of years under his belt, and he's going to be good. I can't believe he beat the Kobayashi Maru.
Yes.
Josiah nodded, having read that in the young man's records.
I hear that Starfleet Academy is still mourning.
The Kobayashi Maru was a test scenario offered by Starfleet Academy to evaluate graduating command cadets to determine viable candidates for future captains. The test, which revolved around a fictitious ship called the Kobayashi Maru, offered a no-win situation. The program required a cadet crew to a vessel in the neutral zone. No solution would allow either the Kobayashi Maru or the ship rescuing her to escape safely. It was designed as a mental problem to see how potential command officers would handle themselves even in dire circumstances. Those results usually decided who would wear captain's gold and who would not. Before JD Dunn, only one person had successfully beaten the Kobayashi Maru, and that was James T. Kirk, whose solution was to sneak in the night before and reprogram the simulation so he could win. However, when JD had tackled the problem, he offered a challenge to the simulated enemies, in this case, the Klingons, to a duel between captains, warrior to warrior with Batleths. Klingon Onar could not allow such a challenge to go unanswered. Thus the Klingon commander had no choice but to postpone the destruction of both the Kobayashi Maru and the Federation ship until the duel was fought. The solution had never been tried, and the programmers of the Kobayashi Maru were forced to admit defeat because the test parameters had been achieved, and Starfleet had a very important question answered regarding the future of Mr. Dunn.
How's he doing in the head department?
Josiah flinched at the phrase, but Buck seemed to have a lot of such sayings, which Josiah was slowly becoming accustomed to.
He was a little nervous, to begin with, but then he's fresh from the academy. You can't expect him to be any other way. His mother died shortly before he graduated, so he's still feeling the loss, but I think you've been a great help to him.
I have?
The first officer looked at Josiah with a hint of surprise JD would have credited so much to him.
He looks up to you.
Josiah wanted Buck to hear this because JD needed his support to reach his full potential.
And I take it you've been making an extra effort to make him feel less homesick?
I remember what it was like shipping out for the first time. It's hard enough when you got family but to have no one.
He lapsed into deep thought because he never did have a family when he joined the academy. His mother had been dead and gone for years by then, and if it had not been for Chris, Buck would have spent a lot of his furloughs alone.
I understand.
Josiah was well aware of Buck's history.
What about you?
Buck choked in mid-swallow, not expecting the question.
What about me?
Josiah smiled, amused by Buck's reaction. Buck tended to play big brother to everyone, whether or not they needed it. As the ship's executive officer, Josiah supposed that quality came part and parcel with the job. Still, the position made it difficult for Buck to confide in anyone else about his troubles other than the captain, and Josiah could understand why Buck would choose not to.
How are you doing since taking the job as the first officer?
Josiah decided he would have to be a lot clearer than he had been if he wished to garner some form of an answer from Buck.
Fine, I guess.
Buck could not understand the need to bring up this subject since the job fit him comfortably.
Why do you ask?
Well, this is your first command on a ship as the exec. It's not like any other job, and save the center seat, it's probably the hardest role on this ship. You're responsible for all the details the captain doesn't have time to deal with but has to be done if the ship is to function.
When you put it like that, you make me nervous.
Buck tugged at his collar. After a moment's reflection, he answered Josiah.
It's harder than I thought. I feel like I've got to keep everything running smoothly so that Chris can do his job, and it's the details that worry me. If I miss something, it could affect the whole ship.
After a moment, he looked at Josiah through narrowed eyes.
How do you do that? How do you just get people to start talking? One minute I say everything is fine, and the next thing you know, I'm unloading on you.
It's what I do,
the counselor said with a smile.
I get people to unload, and most who have something to say will find a way to tell me eventually.
It's sneaky. But to answer your question, now you got it out of me. I'm doing okay, actually. I was scared to death the first few weeks, but I'm getting the hang of it, and on the rare occasions when I ain't, there's plenty of female company around to see me through the rough spots.
Right.
Josiah rolled his eyes,
remembering what a sweet tooth Buck possessed when it came to the ladies on board the ship. It was no wonder the man took his vacations on Risa. Vint Tanner was on his way back to his quarters when he found Lieutenant Mary Travis waiting for him outside his quarters. Vint didn't expect to see her so soon, even though he requested a private audience with Mary earlier today. As the only non-Vulcan on board the ship who had some knowledge of Vulcan culture, Vint had no choice but to approach the protocol officer for help after being ordered by Josiah for his own well-being. As soon as Vint saw her, he wished he hadn't asked her to meet him after his duty shift. Fortunately, he would soon be joining the captain on the holodeck to go rock climbing, so he had an excuse to get this over and done with as quickly as possible.
Vin, I called the bridge at the end of your duty shift, and they said you were heading down here.
Yes.
Vin nodded quietly, always feeling uneasy around her. As someone who knew how Vulcans should behave, Vin always wondered whether or not she was comparing him to the rest of his race. Her son was an entirely different matter, of course. On the occasions, Vin joined Chris and young William for their fishing trips on the holodeck, Vin found it easy to deal with the child. Entering his quarters, he cursed at how messy the room was. In that respect, he was like every other bachelor and did not feel an ounce of regret over that trait. Better that than being so fastidious he would spend all his time picking up after himself.
"I'm sorry,"
he said, picking up some stray clothes from the sofa.
"I wasn't expecting company."
"That's all right. I have an appointment myself, so I can't stay long. What can I do for you?"
She guessed he would be happier if they could get straight to the point. Vin swallowed, wishing he didn't have to do this but supposed it would be easier to speak to her about this than other Vulcans. They considered him an oddity. After all, he was a stranger to their ways even though he was physiologically the same in every aspect. His upbringing disconnected him from everything Vulcan and Vin was sure they blamed him for it, as if he had any choice in the matter.
"I've been having trouble keeping myself from melding with people I touch,"
Vin managed to say after a moment, aware of how Vulcans felt about melding without permission. To them, it was almost like mind rape.
"I see. How can I help?"
"Josiah said you knew something about Vulcan mental disciplines."
Vin wondered if she knew how very hard this was for him because he was unaccustomed to asking for help from anyone.
"I thought you could teach me."
"I know some things,"
Mary admitted readily. Being married to a Vulcan made the study of such disciplines a necessity. While her telepathic ability was awakened, it could never be as strong as a full-blooded Vulcan's, like Vin.
"I could help you with mental exercises and certain techniques about shields if you like."
"That would be good,"
Vin said, relieved that she could help him with this.
"When would you like to begin?"
Mary was aware of how difficult it was for Vin to open up about this. In that respect, he was typically Vulcan. They like to keep their personal affairs just that, personal.
"Tomorrow?"
he suggested because he had to go meet the captain soon, and he really did want to climb that mountain.
"Tomorrow it is then. I'll see you here at the same time?"
"That will be fine."
Vin bid her goodbye with a smile of gratitude as she left the room. After her departure, he took a few moments to compose himself, praying he made the right decision. If it wasn't so severe, he would have preferred to handle this the way he dealt with all things about his heritage. Alone. Sometimes, it was so hard to be Vulcan, even for a Vulcan. Chris decided nothing was going to happen today when he finally decided to leave the bridge and keep his appointment with Vin on the holodeck. Besides, he was starting to believe he had to be infuriating his bridge crew if his science officer was threatening him with bodily harm. Still, who said he couldn't have a little fun at her expense? "Well, this has been fun," Chris rose from his command chair. "But I guess I'll turn the bridge over to you for a while, Commander."
"Thank you, sir."
Sir Alex kept her expression neutral.
"Shouldn't you be running along to the holodeck?"
"If you think that nothing is going to happen."
Chris exchanged a look of mischief with his security chief, who was trying to stifle the smirk on his face and failing.
"Captain, there's nothing out there. Go, climb Machapu Chair. Do Everest if you can. Just go. If there is even the slightest chance that something is going on, I promise we'll let you know immediately."
It took quite a bit to wear her patience, but Chris broke into a grin of triumph.
"If you say so, Commander."
He walked towards the turbo lift, still wearing that satisfied expression when the doors slid open, and he stepped inside to be spirited elsewhere in the ship. Alex relaxed, preparing to go back to work now that she wouldn't be interrupted with ridiculous questions.
"You know, if he wasn't my captain, I'd shoot him."
Commander?
J.D. Dunn spoke up reluctantly.
I'm receiving what appears to be a distress signal.
Alex let out an audible groan about the same time that Ezra burst out laughing.
Get the captain.
She fumed and then gave Ezra a warning glare.
Want to lay odds on who gets their nose broken if they say a damned word?
Chapter 2. The Lennon. 30 minutes after discovering the distress beacon, the bridge officers were inside the conference room, preparing to deliver the findings on their preliminary investigations. The Maverick headed towards the signal at Warp 5 and would allow them to answer the call for help in less than 3 hours. While its origin was no more than a few light years away, the presence of a Federation-type distress signal so far away from the core worlds was reason enough for concern. As Chris sat in his captain's chair at the head of the conference table in the ready room, he tried to suppress the need to smirk each time he looked at Alex. The fortuitous appearance of a distress signal seconds after she sent him off the bridge had left everyone in stitches, and even now, Chris still couldn't help but show how much he enjoyed the whole incident. On the other hand, Alex wore an unreadable mask while silently fuming at the humor being taken at her expense. Chris sat at his customary seat at the head of the table with Alex and Buck flanking him on either side. JD took up position next to Buck while Vin sat between the science officer and Ezra. There was no need to include Nathan, Josiah, or Mary until they had a clearer idea of what they were dealing with.
Okay, Chris glanced at Alex with smug satisfaction. With the personal assurance of our science officer that nothing else is going to happen today, let's get this meeting underway.
Except for Buck and Alex, the other three officers in the room were struggling to maintain their composure. Vin was hiding his mouth behind his hands to mute his sniggers. Ezra was nowhere that subtle, and the dimpled smirk on his face in Alex's direction earned him another glare of menace. JD, who was not about to incur the wrath of a senior officer, bit the inside of his cheek to avoid laughing. Buck looked at his comrades mystified, wondering why his oldest friend, not to mention his captain, was staring at the only female in the room with nothing less than evil mischief. Alex was bristling in annoyance beneath her facade of professionalism, tolerating his behavior for some unknown reason.
What did I miss?
Don't ask.
Alex's frown cowed the three officers for now, but she knew the instant the meeting was over, Ezra would be gleefully filling Buck in on all the details if JD did not do it first.
I'll let you in on it later.
Chris chuckled before deciding it was time to get down to business. Besides, he had no desire to test the boundaries of Alex's patience.
So, JD,
he looked at the young ensign, who also happened to be his navigation and communications officer.
Have you traced the signal?
Yes, Captain.
JD cleared his throat and reminded himself the time for mischief was over.
It's definitely a Federation homing beacon, mostly installed in the DY-500 series. They're old ships, but the recognition pattern is the same. I've run it through the registry, and the frequency matches that of a ship called the Lennon.
Good work.
Buck nodded at him in approval. Once again, a swell of pride at how well JD was doing under his tutelage filled Buck. Most officers his age would be scrambling to maintain their footing in such experienced company, but JD held his own despite his youth. Buck was always quick to let him know those whose respect he wanted so much to earn, noted his ability to handle himself.
What do we know about the Lennon?
Chris turned to Alex. Alex conducted a thorough investigation before this meeting and possessed all the data on the Lennon in her pad.
Until its disappearance more than 6 months ago, she was a commercial freighter owned by a Tellarite trader named Dar Kelizan. Deep Space 5 reports Kelizan did most of his business with the Lysians. The Lennon made a supply stop just before the recent Borg invasion, according to station logs. Nothing was heard since, and it was assumed they abandoned that part of space following the disaster on Lysia. However, I checked with the Spacing Guild, and they have not received any flight plan from the Lennon for quite some time.
They might have run into the Borg when the Collective attacked Earth,
Buck suggested.
But they don't leave anything behind,
Vin countered.
If they could take a starship apart like paper, there would not be much left of a DY-500 series ship if they encountered it. Not enough to leave a homing beacon still operational.
Mr. Tanner is correct.
Ezra agreed readily.
A ship like that would have no chance against the Borg. I believe whatever caused the Lennon to emit its distress signal is not due to the Collective, but something else.
Alex, do we know where they are?
Yes. Judging by the transmission source, it's coming from a star system with an Earth-type sun and four M-class planets. Beyond the notation of its existence, nothing else is known of the system. However, we are the first ship assigned to make comprehensive stellar charts of this area in almost 20 years, so naturally, what's on record is going to be out of date and not all that useful.
So we have no information on what's waiting for us when we get there, other than an old ship thought to have been destroyed suddenly having resurfaced.
Chris disliked the lack of intelligence. He hated going into a situation blind, and when there were civilians involved, he liked it even less.
Pretty much.
Buck shrugged, sympathizing with Chris's feelings on the subject.
How many were on board the Lenin?
250 crew. Mostly Tellarites and humans.
Could they still be alive?
Vin asked.
If they didn't run into the Borg, it is possible there could be survivors.
Unfortunately,
Ezra shrugged.
Having no knowledge as to the nature of their difficulties, we cannot assume anything at all.
The security chief did not wish to sound pessimistic. Still, these discussions were to voice all possibilities, even the likelihood of an unknown threat in this uncharted corner of the galaxy.
I'd like to operate under the assumption that someone is still alive for us to find,
Chris stated after hearing all opinions.
The DY-500 class ships were made to last, and if I'm not mistaken, their life support systems were pretty formidable. They were constructed for deep space missions so 250 people could survive for 6 months or more if they were smart. How long until we arrive?
At our present speed of warp 5, 3 hours,
Vin replied.
Let's take her up to warp 9. I think the Lenin has waited long enough for someone to find her.
The increase to warp 9 significantly reduced the Maverick's expected arrival time at the Lenin's position. Instead of 3 hours, they'd reach the maroon ship in 1. The appropriate departments mobilized for action in preparation for a possible rescue operation. Dr. Nathan Jackson's medical team was prepped and ready to beam to the ship when survivors were confirmed. Meanwhile, Lieutenant Julia Pemberton was organizing a team of engineers to assess the status of the Lenin once they found the vessel. If possible, Chris wanted to salvage the craft. The view screen offered a breathtaking view of an Earth-type solar system, and the yellow star was a spectacular sight in the distant space. A warm amber glow radiated from the sun, enhancing the speckled beauty of the stars around it while bathing its planets in a sea of color.
Have you located the ship?
Yes. It does not appear to be coming from any of the planets or its moons.
Alex continued to stare at the console with some measure of concern.
Then where?
Buck asked before Chris could.
According to my scans, the signal is coming from what appears to be a planetoid or an asteroid. It's just beyond the gravitational pull of their second planet.
Confirmed,
Ezra added, having made his own sensor scans of the system while in search of potential danger to the ship.
There are no other ships in the system or anything resembling technology capable of producing a subspace message. If something is transmitting a beacon in this system, it can only be the Lenin as Commander Stiles stated.
Take us in at half impulse, Chris ordered, and Vin immediately complied. Before them, the stars started moving on the view screen as the great ship sailed forward like a leviathan in the watery depths.
I didn't think there was an asteroid cluster in this area for one to break free and maintain a stable orbit,
JD remarked, hoping that his query might be answered by his more experienced crewmates.
You're right, it is unusual,
Buck agreed.
When speeding through a system like this, asteroids usually have too much velocity to be caught by a planet.
Asteroid coming into range,
JD told Chris.
Let's see what she looks like.
The view screen shifted from the expanse of stars to the asteroid that was the subject of discussion. Although it was small compared to the planet around which it was trapped in orbit, it was sizable for its type. Definitely a planetoid, Chris thought. Its shape was elliptical, with a surface marked by large craters indicating bombardment by other stellar matter during its lifetime.
I have a fix on the Lenin,
Ezra exclaimed.
Magnify,
Buck ordered before Chris could. The image on the viewer changed again. This time, a ship battered by a bad landing on the planetoid's surface appeared before them. Several portions of its hull had been breached with extensive scorching on its upper pylons and damaged nacelles.
We are not going to be able to get that off the ground,
Vin said to no one in particular, even though everyone shared his sentiments.
There are structural breaches everywhere. Is it possible to seal those?
Let's find out, Chris tapped his comm badge. Lieutenant Pemberton, have you been monitoring the situation?
Yes, sir. She's in pretty bad shape, but I don't think she's a lost cause. I need a closer look, but we might be able to save her.
Julia's cheery voice sang across the bridge,
making the chief of security smile. Good, get a team ready. We may be sending you down there.
Chris knew Julia would be itching to get to the Lennon. The DY-500 ships were considered classic, and Chris imagined the engineer was eager to inspect the vessel, even in its dilapidated condition.
No problem.
Captain, there's an atmosphere on that asteroid.
She looked at Chris from her science station with nothing less than astonishment, alarming everyone on the bridge because she was not a woman prone to being caught unawares.
That's impossible.
Buck burst out. On the Nimitz, he played the role of science officer enough to know her claim was incredible.
I'm telling you, my scans are showing a rich oxygen-nitrogen atmosphere, not to mention a gravitational field not dissimilar to ours. There seems to be some kind of strange energy field surrounding the planetoid that might be responsible, but I've never seen field fluctuations like this. It's like a cocoon around the entire body of the asteroid.
Is it natural?
Buck scrutinized it, unable to imagine how such a thing could be.
I don't know.
She surprised everyone because "I don't know" wasn't a phrase familiar to Alex's vocabulary. The science officer always had some kind of an answer, even if it was a wild hypothesis.
Is it a weapon?
Ezra asked, his instincts as a security officer kicking in with this sudden development. Even though he could not see how it could be a threat, any agency capable of providing an asteroid with an atmosphere was nothing to dismiss.
I don't think so. Whatever this energy field around the asteroid is, I have no idea how it's being generated. The sensors won't even penetrate it. It's projecting an intense disruption field the scanners can't get through. I doubt we will be able to get a transporter lock through it.
You mean if there are survivors down there, we're going to have to rescue them by shuttle?
Buck looked at her.
More or less.
Alex shrugged, displeased at being unable to give them any better news. Besides that, there was something about the planetoid, asteroid, that just did not feel right. She couldn't put her finger on it yet, but it was there, tugging at her consciousness, refusing to let go. Chris, who had been silent all this time, finally spoke.
JD, see if you can hail them.
Yes, sir.
JD nodded even though he did not feel very hopeful about their success. If their science officer was correct and she was very rarely wrong about these things, an energy field capable of locking out a transporter signal might be able to keep one out of subspace with just as much ease. As he tried to comply, he was not surprised when his attempts to contact the Lennon was met with cold silence. JD refused to give up and spent the next few minutes switching across numerous frequencies to reach the damaged freighter. Unfortunately, it soon became apparent there was no response forthcoming, and he had to concede defeat.
I'm sorry, Captain. I can't raise the Lennon, and I'm not sure if it's because there's no one receiving us or because we can't break through the interference on the asteroid surface.
It's all right. This whole thing is pretty strange. I didn't expect it to be so easy.
Okay, we can't reach them.
Buck refused to give up on the crew of the Lennon just yet.
So we're just going to have to go down there.
Captain, I object to that.
Ezra reacted immediately to no one's surprise.
We have no idea what is taking place on board the Lennon, not to mention this asteroid. It displays none of the characteristics of a spatial body of its type, and as Commander Stiles pointed out, the energy radiating from it is just as suspect. Traveling to the planetoid may put us in a compromising situation.
I agree.
Alex didn't like the idea of anyone venturing onto that asteroid when so much about it was a mystery.
There are 250 stranded people already in a compromising situation.
Buck met Alex and Ezra's eyes with a hard stare.
We can't just abandon them because it's a little dangerous.
All right.
Chris interrupted before the conflicting opinions became more heated than it should. As captain, it was always his decision at what came next. While mindful of Alex and Ezra's concerns and the need to consider any danger to his ship or his crew, he also had a greater responsibility to the people Starfleet was charged to protect.
Buck's right. If there are people down there, we have to help them, so this is what we're going to do. Buck, you will take an away team to the planetoid. Ezra, you and a full security complement will go with him. Lieutenant Pemberton will accompany you to assess the state of the Lennon. Once you have determined if there are any survivors, I want you to take the shuttle off the surface and give us your report. If you do not report within 1 hour of your arrival, we're coming after you. Is that clear?
Chris's tone indicated there was no room for negotiation on this point. He was willing to listen to their ideas, but the Maverick was not a democracy. Ultimately, the decision was his, and they would do well to remember it.
Aye, sir.
Buck took note of Chris's stern expression and obeyed without further argument.
If you don't mind, I'd like JD to come with us.
JD swung around from the navigator's station, his face filling up with anticipation at the idea of going on his first away mission. It was impossible for anyone who saw that eager expression to be unaffected, and JD's delight dismissed the earlier tension on the bridge.
I don't see why not.
Chris smiled the hopeful expression on the young man's face. Chris met Buck's eyes, wondering if they had ever been that young and eager. Stupid question. Of course they were.
You up for your first away mission?
Yes, sir.
JD answered, practically jumping out of his seat. Vin, however, was not watching the interplay between Captain, First Officer, and the young ensign. His attention was focused on the disturbed expression on Alex's face. Even though he did not mean to intrude, he could sense her emotions better than anyone else on the ship. Right now, the feelings radiating from her revealed she viewed this mission with extreme concern. Whatever gut instinct gripped her, Vin felt it too. And he prayed she was wrong. Chapter 3. Lennon's World. Less than an hour after the Maverick arrived at Lennon's World, the name given to the planetoid offering temporary shelter to the injured ship, the runabout Pearlman launched out of the shuttle bay. The Maverick kept a close eye on its departing child, vigilant at the possibility of danger when their destination was so filled with secrets. Despite the repeated objections of the science officer, Chris's mind was set on letting Buck take an away team to Lennon's World. Although he understood the reasons for Alex's caution, he could not understand the level of apprehension she was displaying at his decision. True, there were riddles to be solved here. Everything about the planetoid made no sense, yet as Starfleet officers, they were obligated to investigate the possibility of survivors and render aid if they existed. When it appeared Chris wouldn't be swayed by her warnings, Alex requested permission to accompany Buck on the mission. Chris refused. This time, his decision was based on the possibility Alex was right. If there was something amiss on Lennon's World and their crewmates ran into trouble, Alex's expertise would be essential in retrieving them again. Throughout his years in Starfleet, Chris worked with many science officers and could say confidently Alex was one of the best. If there was indeed danger on that planetoid, he would need her on the bridge.
Pearlman ready to launch.
Buck Wilmington's voice announced over the comm system.
All right, Buck. Keep an open channel at all times. I expect once you enter the gravitational field of the planetoid, that strange energy disruption will knock out your communications, so remember what I said about reporting in.
Aye, sir.
The first officer understood Chris expected to be obeyed on this point and could not count on their long-standing friendship if he did not do as he was told.
1 hour after we land, I'll take the Pearlman into orbit and give you a report.
Good luck, Commander.
Chris hated being trapped in this chair and not out there with Buck, leading the away mission. This was the most challenging part in transitioning from first officer to captain. On the Rutherford, Chris was just as adamant as Buck about Captain Saville remaining on the bridge while he led the away team. Now he had to abide by the same rules, and he hated it. Sometimes, Chris longed for the days when Starfleet captains could lead every away mission. Now, they were required to remain on the bridge while such landings were undertaken by their capable first officers. Progress, he snorted.
You okay, Chris?
Chris blinked and saw Vin looking at him with sympathy. The helmsman had the uncanny ability to read what was on his mind, and Chris wondered if he was the only one who shared this connection or did it include anyone Vin cared for deeply.
Yeah, I'm fine. Just not used to taking the back seat. I'd rather be out there.
At the risk of bringing up the same point you used on me a minute ago, we need you here in case anything goes wrong.
Chris could not disagree with her. Alex was right. He did use the same argument to make her see reason when he refused her request to allow her to accompany Buck to the surface of Lennon's World. Now Chris had to accept those rules applied to him too. More so because he was captain.
I know.
He eased back into his chair.
It's just that I have a bad feeling about this.
Tell me about it.
Like all good officers, Chris and Alex's instincts guided their actions, and everything about the planetoid seemed to cry danger. What form it would take, however, was still a mystery. Vin shared their discomfort but reminded them why they were bothering with the Lennon at all.
Look,
If Buck's right, there could be people down there who need our help, and they may be able to explain all this.
Chris hoped this was indeed the case. However, with Alex's concerns lingering in his mind, not to mention the fact the planetoid was unlike any other of its type they had ever encountered, he had a premonition that nothing about Lennon's world would be simple.
I don't see why we have to wear these things. I thought we had confirmation that there was an atmosphere on the surface.
Julia Pemberton complained as she reluctantly put on the Enviro suit inside the runabout. She hated how cumbersome they were to wear despite the need to protect themselves against the elements. Through the cockpit of the runabout, the surface of Lennon's world, not to mention the ship itself, was a shapeless blur gaining focus the closer they approached the planetoid. As a precaution, Ezra ordered everyone into their environmental suits if the atmosphere was not as hospitable as the scanners claimed. While he had every faith in Alex's determination that Lennon's world possessed a rich oxygen-nitrogen atmosphere, Ezra was still unable to forget that such a thing was impossible by every science they knew.
"Give it a rest, Lieutenant,"
Buck said from the pilot's seat before Ezra could try a more tactful approach. When it came to Julia, Buck was perfectly aware that Ezra was not firing on all thrusters. Besides, after hearing about their disastrous first date some weeks ago, Buck seriously doubted Julia would be very partial to anything Ezra had to say.
"We're wearing the suits because we have to. This whole planetoid is one big question mark, and until we have some answers, we're going to take every precaution. Besides, while our scanners on the Maverick say that there's an atmosphere, the sensors on the runabout can't confirm it."
Julia didn't miss the command in his voice and suspected he was no longer the happy-go-lucky friend of their off-duty hours but the first officer of the Maverick.
"Okay, but I do this under protest,"
she grumbled before snapping her glove into place and flexing her fingers experimentally within the protection of the soft fiber gauntlet.
"Julia,"
Ezra glanced at the redhead while in the process of suiting up himself.
"I cannot see why you have such an aversion to a rather necessary safety precaution."
"You wouldn't."
She gave him a frosty look as she reached for a helmet.
"What is that supposed to mean?"
Ezra stared at her until he noticed his security team trying very hard to remain oblivious to their exchange. Next to Buck in the cockpit, JD reacted the same way. Just about everyone on the Maverick was aware of Lieutenant Commander Standish's feelings towards their chief engineer and the results of their first romantic evening together. Julia had complained to one of her engineering officers following the event, and the rumor mill soon delivered the tasty morsel of gossip to every corner of the ship.
"Okay, you two,"
Buck spoke up, and this time his tone was stern.
"This isn't the time or the place. I suggest you table it until we get back to the ship."
"Yes, Commander."
Blood rushed to Julia's face in embarrassment.
"We will talk about this later, Lieutenant Pemberton,"
Ezra said, determined to find out what it was he had done that was so wrong. After all, Las Vegas as a venue for a first date was perfectly reasonable. He programmed the holodeck to recreate Caesar's Palace right down to its Corinthian columns. How could she find anything offensive about that? Of course, his attempt to be completely authentic had produced some interesting glitches in the program he was completely unaware of until the date was underway and too late to salvage.
"Don't count on it."
"Oh."
Ezra groaned, hating the fact she was mad at him even though he could not fathom how she could believe the fiasco of the night was his fault or, for that matter, his intention. Buck ignored the interplay between the duo and returned his attention to the planetoid looming larger in the cockpit. As they neared their landing site, they could see the Lennon in the distance. The damage she suffered when she crashed on this rock did not appear as severe as they first thought, and the idea of making the ship suitable for space travel did not seem so improbable now.
"Julia, come take a look at this."
She came forward immediately, still cursing the limitations of the bulky suit as she joined the first officer in the cockpit.
"What is it, Buck?"
Julia stood between him and JD, peering out at the view screen as the Pearlman began its descent onto its rocky and crater-ridden surface.
"There she is."
Buck pointed at the ship. Julia had already spotted it and, as she studied the object of their quest, noted the Lennon was in better condition than she initially thought. While she had every confidence she would get the dilapidated wreck off the ground, she expected the work would require a lot of man-hours to repair the extensive damage. As the Pearlman approached the Lennon, Julia realized she must have been mistaken. The Lennon was nowhere as wrecked as she thought, and it appeared the work required might be cosmetic.
"You know, the damage doesn't look so bad upon closer inspection."
Julia was unable to imagine how she'd misjudged the condition of the ship. It was not in her habit to be so wrong about such things.
JD understood her annoyance.
It sure looked a lot worse when we were on the Maverick.
The first officer said nothing because he studied the ship with similar scrutiny. Like Julia, he was convinced the crash was more severe than it now appeared. Logic dictated a vessel couldn't suddenly become less damaged in the hour it took for them to reach it. Did this have something to do with the distortion field Alex mentioned? Was it capable of interfering with the imaging sensors of the Maverick?
The field must be able to affect the view screen image,
Buck stated, but couldn't keep the skepticism from his voice. Something strange was going on here, and for the first time since he left the ship, Buck wondered if he was too hasty dismissing Alex's calls for caution when it was apparent she had good reason to worry.
So, do you think we can get her off the ground?
Julia turned her emerald-colored eyes on the ship and pursed her full lips in concentration.
As I said, the damage doesn't seem so bad. The hull has been breached in several places, but we've got duranium plating on the Maverick I can use to seal those ruptures. I've got to get inside to take a look. She didn't break up on impact, so I'm assuming the superstructure is still sound. The breaches appear to be the result of a collision, possibly meteor bombardment, but I'd need to examine it with a tricorder to be sure.
That would mean the probabilities of survivors is high.
Ezra entered the cockpit after he completed the briefing to his security team.
Well, that depends entirely on how their life support systems fared after the landing.
Julia replied without any trace of hostility towards him because now her mind was focused firmly on the job at hand.
Are we getting any readings, JD?
Buck hoped their proximity might produce better results. JD let his fingers fly over the keypad on the controls before him, trying to circumvent the wall of disruption, placing them at such a disadvantage in this rescue mission.
I'm sorry, sir, I can't get through it.
JD looked at Buck apologetically.
It's like the severest ionic field disruption I've ever seen.
It's okay. I guess we're going to have to do this the old-fashioned way.
The runabout landed less than 100 meters away from the Lennon. When Buck and the away team stepped out of the small craft, they found themselves on the surface of a shadowy world. What little light there was originated from the planet around which the planetoid orbited. This was just as well because the terrain, what they could see of it, was covered in large craters, and even though the runabout was only a short distance away, it would not be an easy journey. Buck was taking no chances despite the sensors reading an oxygen-nitrogen atmosphere. He didn't intend to risk exposing any member of his team to contagion or any symptoms of the odd radiation emanating from the planetoid.
What a charming place!
Ezra commented as he cast his gaze across the barren landscape of peaks and jagged rocks.
You're the last person to talk about charming places,
Julia muttered as she walked past him to join JD. Ezra paused and swore quietly when Buck sidled up alongside him.
You realize, of course, you're going to be paying for this for the next 6 months.
I am starting to see that.
Ezra sighed loudly as they started towards the Lennon, nestled in a large crater only a few hundred yards away.
I was under the impression Caesar's palace was a tasteful place.
Oh, really? Let me give you some advice about women.
I do not require advice on the female of our species, Commander.
Of course not,
Buck continued, ignoring his remark.
That's why you took your lady to a casino where the girls dance with just about nothing on and two flamboyant men perform magic tricks with large, domesticated cats who require audience participation.
I had no idea that she was going to have to put her head in that tiger's mouth,
Ezra snapped with frustration.
The program was supposed to contain this extremely charming and elegant hotel where there were roulette wheels and baccarat tables. How was I supposed to know that Caesar's palace had been turned into an odious refuge for blue-haired matrons with colorful blouses and sequined eyewear?
Caesar's palace is your idea of a romantic place?
Buck stared at him in disbelief.
Paris is a romantic place. You take a woman there, and I guarantee you will not be sleeping alone. The same goes for London, all that fog and upper crust finery. Rio de Janeiro, during Mardi Gras, and for something more exotic, Jamaica. Trust me, the bikini factor is rewarding enough.
Ezra gave Buck a look.
It terrifies me to know if anything happens to the captain, he will be in charge of the ship.
You're just saying that because I'm right.
Julia and JD were almost at the Lennon's crash site inside the crater. They could see the top of the ship and notice the destruction of its communications array and primary sensor grid. Jagged edges of metal, darkened by heat and fused steel, was all that was left of those vital systems and explained why the Maverick could not hail the Lennon. With the receiver crushed beyond repair, there was simply no way for the ship to hear the starship's signal. The sight of that damaged transmitter sent alarm bells ringing through Ezra Standish.
Commander!
He called out to Buck,
his tone all business because what he deduced was serious. Before he addressed Buck, he glanced at his security team.
Watch yourselves, ladies and gentlemen. I am certain nothing here is as it seems.
What is it?
Buck paused and looked down at JD and Julia moving towards the ship briskly.
That is their communication array, is it not?
Ezra asked Buck once his commanding officer turned to face him.
Yes.
Buck's impatience was visible through the glass of his helmet.
So, how did they send us a distress signal to bring us here?
Buck swung around immediately.
JD, Julia, hold position immediately.
Both officers froze at his bellow and ceased any advance towards the ship. They faced him with confusion until they saw Buck's gesture to Ezra and his security team to go on ahead. Although the derelict spaceship offered no immediate danger, Ezra's statement convinced Buck they were not mistaken about the severity of the damage incurred by the ship's forced landing on this world.
You know the drill. I surely do.
Ezra nodded and turned to his security team.
I want all of you to spread out in pairs and create a defensive perimeter around the ship. You will hold position here for 1 hour. If, for any reason, Commander Wilmington, Lieutenant Pemberton, Ensign Dunn, or myself fail to emerge from this steel behemoth, you are to follow the captain's orders and take the Pearlman back to the Maverick and deliver your report. Is that clear?
But sir,
someone started to speak up. No doubt to voice their dislike of abandoning the senior staff if something went wrong.
You heard the chief's orders.
Buck reinforced Ezra's command.
If something goes wrong, return to the Maverick. Understood?
He looked at the faces around him with hard eyes until they gave him nods to the affirmative.
All right then.
Buck looked at Ezra.
Let's go.
Buck and Ezra joined JD and Julia before resuming their journey towards the hulking mass of steel marooned inside the crater. As they neared the ship, Julia tried to use her tricorder to scan the extent of the damage beyond her visual assessment. However, the device continued to produce nothing but static.
It's no good. The tricorders are absolutely useless.
This is an alarming possibility, but...
Ezra's voice drifted off as he reached for his phaser and fired at an indiscriminate rock lying on the shale-covered ground. Energy exploded out from the weapon and disintegrated the stone into dust, leaving nothing in its place but a darkened stain of charred earth. The ground suddenly heaved beneath them. Julia lost her balance, but JD grabbed her before she could fall. Buck struggled to regain his balance despite the shifting ground beneath him. The tremor rumbled through the earth, making their bones shudder before it finally dissipated a few seconds later.
What the hell was that, Ezra?
I don't think the planetoid is entirely stable.
Julia straightened up and flashed JD a smile of thanks for catching her.
I wanted to ensure we still had weapons,
Ezra explained, embarrassed but unrepentant. It was a necessary test. At least now he knew their weapons were not as useless as their tricorders.
Sir, are you all right?
The anxious voice of one of his security officers shouted from the top of the crater.
Yes, Mr. Katovit, we are all in good health,
Ezra shouted back.
Maintain your post as instructed, and try not to fire your weapons unless absolutely necessary. Apart from everything else, this planetoid is not stable.
Aye, sir.
The response came back promptly as Ezra returned the phaser back into its holster. Buck Wilmington studied the surroundings closely, trying to understand how an asteroid capable of maintaining an atmosphere and gravity was so unstable that a single blast from a hand phaser could cause such a quake. Once again, he wondered if convincing the captain to let them come down here was wise. They didn't have a choice, Buck reminded himself. If there were survivors down here, they would need help.
Ezra, don't do that again.
Julia scowled at him.
Or at least give us some warning.
Buck added.
Buck!
JD called out. While his older companions were discussing the planetoid, JD's attention had been on the ship, and it didn't take him long to make an important discovery.
What is it, kid?
Buck turned to the youth and hurried to join him.
I found an entry hatch,
JD said, unable to hide his excitement as he hastened his pace towards the outline of a hatch along the front pylon. Despite the corrosion from cosmic dust, it seemed functional.
Hey, slow down.
The last thing Buck wanted was for JD's eagerness to lead him into trouble. JD forced himself to stop running even though the urge to keep going was overwhelming. He hated to think his first away mission would end in tragedy if they found no one alive. Still, he waited patiently for Buck when the ear-splitting sound of metal screeched loudly through the air. Turning around, he saw the hatch mechanism activating and instinctively took a step back,
his hand reaching for his phaser. The door creaked loudly, with flakes of corroded metal and dust falling away from the edges as it moved. JD raised his weapon, the sensible thing to do when you didn't know if you were facing friend or foe. Thanks to the strange energy field surrounding the planet behind its impenetrable cloak, JD was not about to trust anything he saw before him. Except the thing before JD was a 16-year-old girl.
Hello, my name is Aislinn.